All right. I think we will get started. I'm not seeing anyone else join in, but we've got 30 odd individuals. We've got about 35 people, 34 people in on the call, so I think we can get started. So I know that there you are, Shelley. Okay. I don't see any. I see Daryl from Councillor Fletcher's office. Is the councillor able to join tonight, Daryl?
I hope so. She does have several other community meetings, though, so.
Okay. All right. Maybe she'll be able to join us in progress. I see Greg from MP de Bruzen's office. I know usually she has meetings on Monday evenings, but Greg, is Julie able to join us this evening?
No, unfortunately, Parliament is sitting right now, so there are parliamentary commitments.
Okay. Just checking. I don't. Hi, Ben. Thank you for joining us this evening. Just saw you pop on. And I'm just checking to see if we have any representation from MPP Tobin's office. Okay. All right. Why don't we get started? It's Ben again. I'll let you back in. All right. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
Great. Thank you for joining us this evening. So, for those of you who don't know me, I think you probably all know me by now, but we may have a few new folks this evening. I'm Mark Clancy. I'm with Metrolinx, and I'm the Senior Manager of Community Engagement for the Ontario Line. And I want to thank everyone for being here with us this evening. This is the fifth Joint Design Excellence Working Group meeting. And I'd just like to remind you that the meeting is being recorded. And the file, Shelley will share the file with you after this meeting tonight. And we will also be posting the audio video file to our Metrolinx Engage page as well. We have a whole suite of information that we are preparing to launch on our Metrolinx Engage page. And as soon as it's live, I'll send the link to everyone on this call. And that way we can distribute the information to others who are not able to participate on these calls. Going to admit a couple more people here. All right. And perhaps we can start with doing a quick round of introductions. So I'm just going to go down my list here. I see a telephone number ending in 4121.
That's Julia Murnahan, Transit Expansion Office at the City.
Hi, Julia. I and Alex. If you can introduce yourself, Alex, I see your name. All right, I'm going to keep going. Andre from Metrolinx.
Hi, good evening. Andre Marwah, Director, Joint Corridor Early Works with Metrolinx.
And I see Anthony from the City of Toronto.
Hello, everyone. I'm in the Transit Expansion Office.
Greg from MPP de Bruzen's office.
There.
Hi, Greg. And Ben from Fontbonne Ministries. I saw you on there, Ben.
Hi, Ben Vizzolo, Fontbonne Ministries.
Catherine Riddell.
Catherine's having audio problems. She's going to log out and try and log back in again. So if you could watch for her, she's trying to fix her audio, but
All
she's
right.
here.
Okay. I'll keep an eye out for her to pop back in. We've
I'm
got
on the phone now.
All right, Catherine.
I don't know if you can hear me, but I'm on the phone and I'm on video, so I'm good. I'm just,
all right.
It's a weird setup.
We can hear you, Catherine. You're good. Daniel Cicero from Metrolinx. Daniel?
Hi, everyone. Daniel Cicero, sponsor. Metrolinx and Caroline.
All right. I saw Councillor Fletcher join as well. Hello, Councillor.
Hello, everybody. I'm here. Thank you.
All right. And we know Daryl from your office is here, Councillor. I've got David Burns from the City of Toronto.
Hi, everyone. David Burns here, Parks, Forestry and Recreation. Thank you.
Hans from the city.
Good evening, everyone. Hans Rick from City Planning.
Doug Jackson.
Yeah, good evening. I'm Doug Jackson. I'm the PM for the consultant team, for the technical advisor.
Jennifer Lay.
Hi, Jennifer from the Riverside BIA. Thanks.
John Potter.
Yes. Hi, I'm John Potter from the Ontario Line sponsor team.
Okay. Celia. Celia Johnston.
Yes, Celia Johnstone, lead architect with the Ontario Line TA.
Next, I have Rachel.
Good evening, Rachel Drisma with the Ontario Line Technical Advisor.
And Josephine.
Good evening, this is Josephine Young from City Bridges Expressways and Structures. Thanks.
And I have a telephone number ending in 3962. Is that you, Catherine?
No,
that's me.
Who was that? 3692? 3962?
It's Catherine. Catherine.
Oh, hi, Catherine. And Teresa. Hi, Teresa. Have I missed anyone on this evening's call?
The other person was a Catherine Deegan from Leslieville BIA.
Oh, hi, Catherine.
Hi, Mark.
And Mary Rowe from Riverside. I live on Queen Street.
Hi, Mary.
Also, Paul Bakowitz is joining us at around 6:30, quarter to seven. So if you can keep an eye out for him, he's going to be, he's driving in from far away.
All right.
It's Tony Whitaker from First Avenue and Logan Avenue.
Hi, Tony. Yeah, it's interesting. Okay. And I've got Claudia.
Good evening, everyone. Claudia Biela, Urban Design and Landscape. TA.
Shauna.
Hi, everyone. Shauna Bowen from Urban Design, City Planning, City of Toronto.
And Renita.
Good evening. Renita D'Souza from City Planning, City of Toronto.
And John Barrio.
Yep. Good evening. This is John Barrio, Junior Noise and Vibration Engineer with Hatch.
All right. I think I've captured everyone. And Kyle Poole, I see you joined.
Yep, Kyle Poole, Senior Project Coordinator with Parks, Forestry and Recreation.
And Rosemary.
Good, yes, I'm the last one, I think, am I? And I guess I'll just take this opportunity to say, on behalf of the CAC, I'm a resident of Leslieville, Riverside, and a member of the CIC, and we want to be on the record, this is the fifth meeting, as continuing to object to building the Ontario Line along the elevated rail corridor through Leslieville and Riverside. Metrolinx hasn't fulfilled the promise that was made to our community or multiple requests from Toronto City Council to sincerely consider the option of putting this 1.5 kilometer section of the Ontario Line underground. We've been told that it's going to cost an extra $850 million to put it underground. Well, if you insist on putting it above ground, then we want to insist that a good chunk of the money that is saved be put into mitigating the effects, the enormous impact that the Ontario Line is going to have on our community's health, safety, and well-being. So we're here sort of under duress. We want to, if it's going to happen, make it the very best that it can be for our community. So thank you, and we're ready to move forward.
Thank you, Rosemary. And Roberto, I see you've joined us as well.
Yeah, yes.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, Roberto Donatelli from Metrolinx Project Delivery Team. Thank you, Mark.
Okay, thank you. Any other opening comments before we begin?
Yes, it's Councillor Fletcher. I'd like to make a few opening comments, if I can, please.
Sure, go right ahead.
Great, thank you so much, Mark. Just like Rosemary, of course, I will say that we're here under duress because the Metrolinx has ignored our request to put this line underground, 1.7 kilometers underground. But what I'm going to ask, Mark, is that you start five meetings in and with very clear, here are the dates for the RFP. Here's what's going out in the RFP. That is, and here is what the treatments, here's how the treatments will go out. So where the walls are going, where the everything that you've got technically that has to go out, and then all the wall treatments, what is the deadline for those? They're, I believe they're different, and I'm very concerned that we've been five meetings and we don't have that slide. Number one slide. Here's the work plan. Here's your requirements. Here's where we have flexibility. Here's the dates that everybody has to meet and you have to meet. And I'm going to ask Mark if you have that tonight as the first slide for this meeting.
We do have that information for you, Councillor, and Teresa and the team will share that information with you for sure.
And Teresa, I'm going to ask you if that's the first thing you're going to show us so we all understand the context of this discussion.
First slide. Yes, Councillor.
Thank you. Thanks very much, everybody. And I did meet with City Transportation today around all the permits for all the work that's going to happen. So community members, we will be having quite a few discussions and I will be holding some meetings, inviting you to attend, of course, Metrolinx, because there's so many permits that you need in order to actually get on the tracks, because you own the tracks, but we own all the rest of it. So that, I hope we can have a good conversation and get to a good place. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fletcher. I just wanted to say, I saw MPP Peter Tobbins join us. Thought I saw him come online. There you are. Good evening. You're on mute. Would you like to say a few words this evening, MPP Tobbins?
I do. I appreciate my colleagues' intervention, making sure that we have clarity as to when things are happening and what's happening. I apologize to all. I just got out of the chamber and I've got three Metrolinx related meetings this evening, so I won't be here for very long, but I wanted to at least get a sense of where things were going. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, I think we are ready to dive in, so let's begin the presentation. Thank you, everyone. So next slide, please. All right, I'm gonna start off with the land acknowledgement. As with all of our meetings here, we do take the moment to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of Indigenous peoples, including the Anishinaabe, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples. We are all treaty people. Many of us have come here as settlers and immigrants in this generation or generations past. Metrolinx declares its commitment to building meaningful relationships with Indigenous peoples. We acknowledge the historic and continued impacts of colonization and the need to work towards meaningful reconciliation with the original caretakers of this land. We acknowledge that Metrolinx operates on lands covered by 20 treaties and that we have a responsibility to recognize and value the rights of Indigenous nations and peoples and conduct business in a manner that is built on the foundation of trust, respect, and collaboration. Next slide, please. Oh, we have a new safety moment for you this evening. So just wanted to share with you all, I know that we're all spending a lot of time looking at our computer screens, probably more so than ever since many of us are working remotely, and obviously we're all working very long hours. So there is a rule, 20-20-20, every 20 minutes, take a 20-second break and look at an object 20 feet away, and that will just help reduce any eye strain or eye fatigue that you may be experiencing throughout the day. So a quick safety reminder, but I think very beneficial since we spend so much time looking at our monitors. All right, next slide, please. All right. I'll hand this over to you, Teresa.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. And nice to see everybody this evening. Just a reminder, some rules of engagement for tonight's discussion. Please remain muted and reduce all kind of background noise unless you're called upon. And questions will be taken tonight in order they were received. I'm monitoring the chat on the right-hand side of our discussion. Please use the little hand up icon if you would like to speak. Roberto, if you already have your hand up right now, so I just want to point that out. If you have a question, I'll pause, but I think you might still have it up from earlier. A couple of other housekeeping items. Please make sure that you're respectful to all meeting participants and allow everybody the opportunity to speak before speaking a second turn related to an issue. Your video is encouraged but not required, and as Mark said, just a reminder, this meeting is recorded and will be shared online later. Okay, thank you for that. And next slide. So quick agenda for tonight's discussion. I'm going to get right to the heart of some of your questions right away before we get to the meat of the agenda. We're going to talk a little bit about the noise barrier analysis so you understand how we got to where we were and what's on the table still moving forward. We've got the bridge parameters. Last the time we were together, you asked about the bridge design and how far and what that looked like. We've sent you a work back schedule and some engagement opportunities we want to talk through today. And the purpose of today's meeting for us is to really walk out of here with your agreement to what engagement approach you want to carry forward. So if there are still technical questions we need to answer, we're doing that on a parallel agenda as we are also preparing for the engagement process moving forward, so we don't lose time in the logistics management of that. And then the city has a presentation tonight, about 25 minutes, so I'm hoping that we give them time for that at the end of our discussion today to discuss park impacts and opportunities. So with that, I'm just going to jump straight to Councillor Fletcher's concern. What's in the RFPs and what is that schedule? So you can see what we've done is further adapted the package slides that we've been presenting, so it clearly defines what is in each package and what is the schedule. However, we want to clarify a couple of items based off of our work with you and our engagement process, knowing that we need to come back to some decisions in an engagement approach. So first off, in package number one, this is our early works package. This is going RFP in market in April of this year. And it will be in market through August 22. Construction start is September 2022. This is really the baseline engineering package that we've talked about in the past. It includes the engineering design of the retaining walls. We want you to recognize that the custom form liner that we've talked about at our last meeting will come late in the process based off our engagement approach with you, and we will make an addendum or a contract change to it later in September when we get your input to make sure that that is carried forward in construction. The engineering design of the noise walls, the baseline engineering that we've been talking about, will move forward in this first RFP, but the transparency, opacity, the style finish, we're going to talk about that material today, that will come later in an addendum and a contract change. So we have time to get your input. We'll include the three GO bridge replacements at Queen, Dundas, and Logan, the two new Ontario line bridges at Dundas and Logan, the rail corridor grading, drainage and utilities, and the GO track locations in construction. Package number two, which is in...
That's the city's bridge. I'm sorry. The city has a bridge at Logan. It's not the GO Bridge. So if we could be clear, that is the City of Toronto Bridge. You own four and the city owns one, right?
Thank you. Rachel, can you comment?
Councillor Fletcher, I think we only intended it for it to address that it carries the GO tracks.
I know. I think it's really important that we know that it's not yours, because the corridor, you own it, but you do not own that bridge. The city owns it. So let's be really clear who owns what property, because it's all about property now. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, package number two is the urban design and landscape package. A lot of what we're doing outside of some of those customizations I talked about in early works package number one are included in this package. RFP is due into market in 2023. That includes noise wall screenings, the bridge underpass public realm, bridge underpass lighting, the bridge underpass activation. We're going to talk about all of that today. Landscape and vegetation mitigation, tree planting, retaining wall mitigation, and then the vegetated terraces and or embankments with the T-walls. On package number three, this is the RFP issued in January 2023 through February of 2024, includes the Riverside and Leslieville and Girard stations integrated with the Ontario Line bridges at Queen Street and Girard and Carlaw Avenue. Councillor?
Oh, yeah, I'm just going over the early work civil, and you're extending, you've got a contract addendum, and what would happen there? Can you be clear on that? Because we don't all do RFP. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and Andre or anybody else that wants to come online, so what we wanted, we need to move forward with the tender package for the early works, that baseline engineering that needs to move forward right now. But it doesn't mean that we can't come back later to the contractor and say, we have some changes in that contract and we need you to implement those changes. So those specific changes are some of the customized features that we're going to be design features that we're talking about with you in the customized design guidelines that we want to develop in partnership with you for the joint corridor. So, Shelley.
I'm wondering, like it says, engineering design of the noise walls. Is that material can be changed, or are we stuck with that material and we can just make it different kinds of opaque?
So that's a really good question, Shelley, that we're actually going to talk about in the noise wall presentation, but I'll just let you know right now, based off what we heard from you and your major concerns with the material of the noise walls, we've readjusted our process to get your input into that before we move that forward. So the material of the noise wall will move forward. The baseline engineering will move forward. There are some things that are still constrained, but we are asking and putting some time in place to get your input on that material so we can come together around whether that's translucent or opaque. And I'll talk about what that looks like when we get into the noise wall discussion.
Just to follow up there, Teresa. So your RFP is going out. What's your date you're sending it? There's 30 days in April.
I believe the date is April 25th was the last date for input. So that would mean in that last week of April, that RFP would go out. I don't know if we have an exact date on that.
Okay, so work back from there, April 25th. What is included and what is still to come with an addendum?
So what will come in the addendum is the custom form liner on the T-wall. And then the materials decision on the noise wall. So that's whether it's transparent, the opacity, the style, and the finish. And mainly those two items. And then there's urban realm. That's all for the bridges. That's all included in package two. I was about to make a mistake.
Okay.
So, and we're working towards, and that will align nicely with our engagement strategy.
And have you come to a budget number yet as far as the custom form liner on the T-wall, the noise wall finishes, that you have a ball to work with?
Yeah, so part of developing the TOR for either Design Strat or the design competition, we need to come to terms with what the parameters of what that will be so we can give that to either the design team for the Strat or the design teams for the competition. So not yet, but we will put parameters around what that budget will look like once we develop the TOR. The terms of reference.
Yeah, excuse me. The terms of reference. So do you have a ballpark for that at the moment? Do you have, yeah, obviously, no?
We do not. I think what we really want to do is work with the community and the CAC here to define the terms of reference. And so once we get that in place, it will give us good criteria to put that budget together.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. So that was really kind of big question number one that I know you guys wanted to get to right away. You know, on the next slide, I had a different slide, but it just kind of a reminder of what we're working towards. That purple transparent, go ahead back to the other slide. Thank you. That one, this is where we're doing most of our iteration to make sure we capture your input into both the elements of the early work civil package and the urban design package. So just a reminder of where we've been. Also, all of the engagements that we've had over the course of the last year to get to where we are today. On the next slide, you'll see the two work back schedules that we provided to you over the weekend to consider. And what I'd like to jump into are your direct questions that were based off of the information provided over the weekend. Shelley.
Sorry, I just had a question about that other slide you just jumped by. Just go back one. I had asked Mark, but we were trying to clarify. You've got construction starting in July. So I had asked what construction is starting in July if the RFP is going out in April, at the end of April. Yeah.
I think that honestly, if I remember correctly, Andre's probably going to kick me. We fix or not, Nima. I think that's a typo that I keep forgetting to remove. So it's later. Okay. I know there are early works activities occurring in the corridor. So that's where that range came from. But the official construction for this particular package is September, is later.
Okay, but we can fix that, right? We can all agree that that's a typo, and we can say construction start August, September, which is what you had on another slide. Is that right?
Yeah. Andre, if you want to verify for me, just give me a thumbs up.
Yeah, no, that's correct. Yeah, we'll get that fixed.
And I apologize. That was on my punch list, and I overlooked it. Okay. And Rosemary.
Could you just go back to the slide, the previous slide to this one that you've got up now for a sec? Okay, thanks. So are you, this one. Thank you. So are you saying that the addendum that will be where we get to have the input has to be, like that input has to be done by the end of August if construction's starting in September? Is that correct? Like you're saying the custom form liner can come late.
Yeah, we definitely want to get. The input into those elements we're trying to achieve through the design charrette or the design competition. So ideally, a lot of the guidelines that we're working towards will be developed in this between now and April, and then how those then are applied to design is what we'll be working forward from an implementation perspective, and to make sure that's incorporated appropriately into the design so we can issue an appropriate contract change.
Okay, so I think I understand that. So then what is noise wall screenings that is in package two that is different from the noise wall finishes? I guess I'm not sure about that. Thank you.
The technical team is on, you know, a lot of what we're going to be discussing with the noise walls and getting that transparency, opacity, style, and finish determined really goes into the actual materiality of the noise wall. Some of the screenings will be other type of features, like even vegetative screenings, maybe wood paneling and more.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to keep moving then and get, let's go to the work back schedules. So we provided two options for you with the work back schedule. So you can see how we would implement a design competition versus how we would implement a design charrette. I'm going to go ahead and, Shelley, just address your questions that you sent right now so I can, and I'll just run down those questions and answer them specifically. So let me just get my notes up. Okay, so the first question that we had was related to the design competition, and the question was what was being entered into the design competition. And essentially what we would be putting in the terms of reference, and we would actually use the Leslie Barnes terms of reference as a baseline, working with you to refine those. We would essentially include all of the elements that we've been talking about for what's on the table for the T-walls, what's on the table for the noise walls, and what's on the table for the bridges. So we would be going through the process of in either approach to get your input and include that in the competition or in the charrette. The second question that you had was, you know, specifics of what is being competed for and what design opportunities will be rewarded. And basically, again, in the TOR, we're going to define those specific elements of what I just discussed, of what's on the table. All of the slides that we've presented where we have the fixed constraints and opportunities for input, and we'll look at those again today, that's exactly what will be in the competition or in the charrette. Is the charrette or the design competition benefiting the community? I think what this does is allow some of the things that we've heard from you. The design competition will invite a broader, different perspective to the table for design for some of these inputs. It will benefit the community because you'll get some of that outside perspective that you're seeking. You'll see later in our presentation, we talk about the benefits and kind of compare the design competition to the design charrette. And this addresses one of your questions as well. The design competition limits iteration with the community in a way that a design charrette allows. So it still benefits the community because it does reach some of your objectives, but it doesn't allow for as much engagement as a design charrette would. And that's just because of the time and the type of procurement process and what you need to do to go into a traditional engagement process. Now, the public could engage and the CAC engages, and we'd love your engagement to develop the TOR for both scenarios. We want your engagement to help us develop the criteria for the winning team. So that's a key, what you think will be important in winning that, in winning the selection. We want you, and for the jury requirements, what are the requirements and criteria for jury selection? We absolutely need your help and engagement in the visioning and the walking tours. We will select the jury, we will conduct the final competition, but we would also invite participation in that jury. And then we would implement those design, based off of the winner of the design competition, we would move forward with those design guidelines. Shelley, question.
So you're selecting the jury? I think my vision is that the community is the jury.
So the community, so there, I think what we're working towards is a criteria for the jury that we would do together. And then based off of the, I think the base, and I we could work on that process together, Shelley, I believe, like to determine who's selected and how it's selected. I think it's definitely a partnership. I don't think it's done in a silo.
Yes. I mean, ultimately, if the community wants to choose the design, I mean, that's why we're here. We want to choose the design. We don't want to go through this process and then have Metrolinx pick something. So, you know, that's a really big reason why we wanted a design competition, but also because it should belong to the community and it should be the voice of at least the majority of the community. So I'll just leave it out there right now. We can work through a process, but that's our expectation.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Can I just walk you through? Yes. So I think the really important part, and my motion at City Council was very clear that the city would be involved in ensuring design excellence. So I haven't heard how you're engaging our public realm division there, and I'd like to hear from them. And that is coming up. March 7th is next week. So I don't know if you're joined at the hip or not, but that is the expectation. Number one. I'd like to hear you answer.
Of course. And the city has been a really great partner, actually, to get us to where we are today in defining both approaches. Julia, I don't know if you're the right person to answer that question on behalf of the city about our engagement and your participation in defining these approaches.
So in addition to these meetings, we've been meeting specifically regarding this working group two or three times a week with Metrolinx. And this is the more detailed look at how we're working together. We have been consulting with Metrolinx, or Metrolinx has been consulting with the city, including city planning and PFR and transportation for over a year now. And we've been part of the process throughout. So I hope that that's...
this is a brand new process now that was set up.
This is a new process, building off of the feedback that we have provided to date. Yes.
Yes. So I'm just asking Metrolinx, what official role does the city have in this design competition approach, please?
I'll take a stab at answering, and I know Malcolm's on the phone too, but they're our partner in this, you know, side by side. So like Julia said, we work through these presentations, we come up with the agenda together, we came up with the approach together. I take all of their feedback every, you know, two, three times a week on the approach and the content of these presentations to make sure that their thoughts and the city's perspective is implemented in both the content of what we're talking about, but also the approach moving forward. So, and I would anticipate that continuing as we move forward. And then, you know, they're reviewing a lot of the material as we're developing it in preparation for these discussions. They would be a part of the TOR early before we get you the draft. They'd be a part of the rest of the materials, the jury selection, all of that as well. So Shelley and then Mary.
A few more. Who will select the firms now for the short list of the firms? How will you select those?
Yep. So, you know, part of it is making sure that we follow a good procurement process that's fair and equitable. And so we would identify some qualified firms in partnership with you. We'd make sure that they were up to the standards, and then we'd basically submit an RFI, request for information, for those that would be interested. We would do a Q&A with those that are interested, and then work through the procurement process to make sure that those that were interested could participate.
Okay.
I would like and them to have access to the community as well, so that they can hear the community as part of the process. So we would be willing to work through that, the CAC, to interview these chosen firms and or to help in the selection process.
Can I just finish here? Because this is a pretty traditional process, Shelley, in which the community, this is all done, so making sure everybody has their qualifications and have done this kind of work, etc. And then whatever happens to give the actual, however they're going to start designing based on a conversation with the community, so then that's, here's what everybody's thinking. Then that design comes back, and generally those will all be part of a community, should be out for the community to have a look at. But also for public art, there's a jury selection. There can always be a community member there, but there's a very defined process for public art, which is interwoven with the agencies and the community. And I think it's pretty standard, and we should try to work within that. We've done that for everything at all the different art that you see in the neighborhood. So it works quite well, but it's not left in Metrolinx's hands to determine. And somewhere along the line, there's a budget or a number that everybody knows what it is. So that is, I'm coming back to the money again. And yeah. I think that needs to be front and center so we don't get cheap.
I think we're on the same page, Paula. I want to make sure that it's not a one-size-fits-all solution, that some neighborhoods have different requirements. We obviously have parks areas that we've talked about. And I want to make sure that we're not looking at just one one element. We're looking at the multi dimensions of where this wall backs onto, where it fronts onto, and how best to serve the entire 2 kilometer section of the joint corridor, because it's very varied. So I just want to make sure that we're sort of putting that language into the RFP as well, and that we have a chance to review that before it goes out for tender.
Yes. And then there's the, well, that would be part of the walking tour. Everybody who was, I think that was how are they being engaged to see all the various areas along the tracks, particularly, and how they all approach it. But I think we're coming to a good place here.
Yeah, me too.
I'll add that the Leslie Barnes design competition is where we're going to lean on for best practices and precedents. So, and our goal is to only go up from there how it was
done presented. That myself, I know all about it. So we had the budget. We knew how much money there was, $700,000, $750,000 for that wall. Probably went way over that. And firm selected. There was a lot of outreach. But there was no community involvement in kind of looking at the zone. This is very different because nobody lived down there. Everybody lives along this corridor and it's full of parks. So I think, while I think you say go up from there, I'm pleased to hear that, Teresa, because that's just the kind of baseline. But it has to be much value added on how the public was engaged at that particular project, which I'm extremely familiar with.
Yeah, and I have a slide later that talks about how we can go above and beyond in that public engagement as well, with some of the ideas that you brought to us a couple presentations ago by doing some of the, you know, street interviews and pop-up events. And we can still do all of that for both of these options moving forward. So none of that is something that we intend to do with your guidance and support as well. So, okay, Mary's had her hand raised for a little while. Mary?
Patient.
Mary is infinitely patient.
Yes, she is.
I just want to put a plug in for having somebody from the community involved in the jury selection. I think I appreciate the leadership the city is taking here. It has years of experience. It's in the DNA of the city to be able to provide that kind of expertise and also the process support that the councilor was just mentioning. And just for my community, my colleagues from the community, you know, the community can get gamed if you don't have the benefit of other public authorities that have a broader public good outlook here. So I think it's a partnership for all of us, I think. And obviously people like us who live here want to have a direct say, as Shelley is consistently saying, and that's true. So that in that spirit, I would say, why not have a process so that one community member has some input into how you select your jury? We don't have to do the whole thing, but just let us have input. And I really am, as I said, very appreciative that the city is coming in this way, because they know how to do this really well. And it argues for a much better output, I think, if we have this kind of collaboration.
Yeah, if you have a community member on the jury along with the others, that's also an option too.
Yeah, that's also an option. Yeah.
I would very quickly volunteer Paul Bakowitz to keep him in mind, and we can come back to that, but I think he's highly qualified.
Great. Okay, I'm going to move us forward in continuing to answer your questions specific right now to the design competition. So so the question was about timeline and what was happening between today and March 7th, and why can't the qualified firms be contacted in the next day or so? And the process really just has to be met to the standards of Metrolinx's procurement requirements. So we have to do a fair, open, and transparent process and solicitation for inquiries. So we need to develop that process. We'd like that inquiry to be tied to, we want the time to actually identify some of those qualified firms, vet those firms with you guys, make sure you're comfortable, and then start to solicit that invitation to participate that's in line with any procurement requirements that we have to follow. So that's really what the gap is intended for. Next question was about terms of reference, about who will be responsible for creating those. And I've mentioned that we'll be partnering that. We'd like to kick that off this week with a decision moving forward on which process you'd like to move forward. And we want to get those terms of reference in development so we can get an early draft and discuss with you next week. Moving to the visioning and public engagement, we proposed that over the week of March 21st. and other area, or in March 14th, there was a comment that this is going to conflict with March break, and so we will reevaluate our schedule and we'll make some changes to it to accommodate that. That's certainly, that's a great comment and something I wasn't aware of when I put dates down, so we'll make sure that that gets changed. Charette follow-up, the question was, what exactly is meant to happen during the charrette follow-up? And this was a comment that we actually got from the city that we might get the right amount of outreach from or input on. So, or we might need to extend our charrette days over the course of 2 weeks versus 1 week. And so we just put that in there as an opportunity to have additional follow-up and take advantage of that time. And the charrette really is more of an iterative process. So where the community is a part of the process from the design competition each way, the charrette is actually done with the community. And so you're included in every single iteration of decision-making, where in the design competition, you get to help select the jury, help select the criteria for winning, help select the term and define the terms of reference. But after that visioning and public engagement, that those teams have to get to work, and then you select one and move forward. So your input from the visioning to the end is really limited. I know they'll be reaching out for input and more. It's just less structured. It's less of an iterative process, but the design charrette is intended for a more iterative process. And then finally, your comment was about the draft guidelines being presented the week of April 18th, which is well over a month from the design charrette. And that's just an opportunity for our teams, just like the design team for the design competition, to do their own finessing of what that looks like. So, you know, making sure that we've incorporated the input, we're vetting it through the CAC, making sure that we're moving forward accurately, and we've captured all of the right direction, information, and content before we move forward with a draft final design guideline. Okay, that was a lot of me talking. Shelley, did I get to all of your questions? Do you feel like we adequately covered those?
I'm still unsure of what the charrette is for. If we put this out for competition, what is the charrette doing? I'm still not understanding.
So the design charrette is a similar process where you use the resources, the staff, the talent that you have on your existing team, and do move an engagement process forward. Where either way you come up with the same content, either way we're getting to the same deliverable, which is that design guidelines for the joint corridor. The charrette is just leveraging the city staff and talent, the Metrolink staff and talent, and the TA staff and talent in partnership with the community to do more iteration around those design guidelines. So, you know, we have global experience from the combination of our three partner, the TA team, the Metrolink's team, and the city. And we feel like we could bring in a lot of great global experience to this process too and get to the same outcome. It really is just, we do it through the design competition or we do it through a design charrette.
Okay, we're gonna have to take that off and have a discussion about that as the CAC and see where everybody's standing on that, but let's just move forward with that.
Where does is Metrolink's preferring the charrette? Is that what I'm hearing?
I think that, and we don't want to lead you down. I mean, we're open and willing and totally committed to doing either of these. I think between all of us, we have more schedule control and more iteration with the charrette process than we do with the design competition. And so we feel like it would be easier and inclusive of the community in a much more iterative process and leverage our own experience in a way that can achieve exactly what you're looking for. We all, from a technical expertise perspective, myself included, you know, we learn how to do the charrette process in, you know, the first year of school in urban planning school. So, you know, it's a applied approach to the work that we do. The city is used to doing it and appreciate the process and approach. So I would say, do we have a preference? Both options are on the table. We're totally committed to what the community wants to do. we just think there's options to get to what you're looking for, and these are the two best paths to get there.
So I just want to say, I realize I'm jumping the queue, but I just want to say that I think then that the trade-off might be you're comfortable with the process. Planners are trained to do it. It's an iterative process, but it might not generate the quality of excellence that a design competition could. I wonder if anybody would agree with me on that. I'm interested to hear what the city thinks.
Yeah. Julia or Tina?
I think there's still a lot of opportunities for taking a look at some of the options that Metrolinx has already put on the table, some of the things that we've already discussed in great detail between Metrolinx and the city, presenting that information to the community in a charrette format, and then selecting from some really excellent design options that the community would be able to make a choice on what is included and what isn't included. But there is a lot of design excellence that has already gone into some of the options that are available to us. So I think I don't think by saying that we're choosing a charrette that we're automatically a lower level of design excellence.
No, Teresa, this is Doug. I'll just add again, I mean, from an engineering standpoint, and having done these on other significant infrastructure projects, I would say, you know, we've seen some very positive examples of the community involvement in the charrette process and multiple chances for the community to kind of give their input and then to see the follow through from that process directly on the designs that come out. So again, I think both of these methods can, you know, achieve what we're trying to do here in the corridor, where the one Rosemary might have, you know, the trade-off with the design excellence, the other one might have a trade-off with how much actual community engagement you can get into the process.
Thank you, Doug. Rosemary, did that answer your question? Hand raised from Renita, and then Tony, and then I've got a comment in the chat.
Well, I guess my question was, is it not possible to somehow combine these to be the best of both worlds and have a charrette, but invite some of the firms that you might have identified to participate in a design competition to just come and participate in the charrette process and give us their input at that time and in that way? Just a suggestion.
Well, just if I can just step in, it's John Potter here. Rosemary, to your point, there is a mechanism the city already has, and we've worked with them many times on joint design review panels, which are, you know, made up of peers and people who are recognized from around the city for their expertise and their excellence in design. That is another option to have them participate in the charrette process, or at least present to them to get feedback, and that would be in the design charrette process would be your sort of your external sort of experts and top line designers who would be feeding in. I mean, most of the teams that we would be approaching in the city sit on one of either the City of Toronto Design Review Panel, the Waterfront Toronto Design Review Panel, or Metrolinx's own design review panel. So that is in the charrette process, maybe one way to get you the sort of external review that you might be looking for.
Yeah, and maybe even incorporating some of that design competition, like you just said, like a mixture of both. And maybe firms with the qualified firms that we're looking for. So maybe they're not in a production role, they're more in an advising and guiding role. We can take all of this back to the table. It sounds like we're not quite here for a decision yet. I want to answer some of these other questions and then come back to this. I know we have quite a lofty agenda still to get through today, but we'll close out our discussion today with this as well. But I think that we can probably achieve everything that you're looking for with maybe a modified version of both. And still get that design excellence and achieve the design excellence moving forward. So I like that suggestion a lot, and I can take that back to come up with a hybrid approach as well. So, Renita.
Thanks, Teresa. I think Rosemary and John captured most of what I was going to say, but I think, Mary, just to your point, if you didn't feel like there was good enough expertise within the community, I feel like, you know, the design competition route may have been something you would have chosen, but just recognizing the type of expertise that exists within the community, I think that it would be, it's just my opinion, but I think that having the expertise that already exists and is known to be really good participate in the process, as opposed to leaving some other consultants take it away and then you just seeing the final product, in my opinion, is something you want to do as part of this working group.
Thank you, Renita. And Tony.
Thank you. Part of the reason for the engagement approach was the fact that we were not happy with the design elements which we've been shown, and this was the reason for the community's involvement in the noise walls and the retaining walls and the bridges and the underpasses, and I'm not talking about the landscaping, I'm just talking about the physical structures. So I think that we have at least one architect in the community, and we have other people who have expertise in engineering construction, that I think we should move ahead with the selecting a jury and having the design competition. We have enough expertise within the city, within the community, for this to happen. And it's all nice to talk about hybrids and keep everybody happy on all sides, but I think we need some action on this. We need to get moving on this thing. We're in week number 5, and we talked about this 3 weeks ago, and when you opened up the process, and we're still sitting here discussing it. So I would like to suggest that we get moving with this, that we are quite happy. I'm quite happy to have a design competition. I have to discuss it with the rest of the group, of course, but that would be my push, because we do need a jury, and we need to tell us from an envisioning point of view how we can improve on the noise walls and the retaining walls, the way they've been designed, or the way that we're going to have to live with as a community over the next 50 years, 100 years, whatever. And now is the time to do that and take it very seriously. But let's get going. I mean, we're already at February 28th, and April 25th is only 8 weeks from now. So that would be my comment. Well,
thank you, Tony, and I appreciate that. It sounds like Shelley's going to take the action to work with the CAC and confirm on a path forward. And you have that time right now, which is okay. You know, we've built into this schedule. This week, we're really going to focus on developing those terms of reference so you guys can deliberate and decide what your path forward is. So we'll give you the time to do that. And then and we'll come, you know, hopefully back together. You know, we'll come next week. We'll start to pull in some of these activities with which direction you decide later this week. So we'll be in touch on that. So, but thank you, Tony. I appreciate that. I'm going to go to the chat really quickly because there's a couple comments there. And then Catherine, I'm going to come back to you. So wondering why we haven't done a charrette previously. Why wasn't that done? I can't answer that. I wasn't a part of the engagement approach before. I know specifically what I was brought to the table to help with you in particular was to achieve a better process moving forward. And so these are ideas that with the city and the Metrolinx team, we've thrown up on the table. So I can't answer why we haven't done them before, but we're committed to a new engagement process moving forward. And that's what we're here to do today. Peter has left the building. And then is this an international design competition is the question that Catherine had. Catherine, was that also why your hand was up? Okay, I'm going to imagine so. So, you know, I think that what we are challenged and have some constraints when it comes to soliciting for feedback. I think we would open the process to international firms that wanted to participate. But I think, as Renita said, you have a wealth of great resources within the community of Toronto. And through our own A&E industry connections, we have a wealth of resources as well. So I think We will identify some firms to bring to the table international, you know, based off the what we can achieve within the parameters that we're working towards. So I don't know if John or Malcolm or anybody else wants to comment on that, but there are great resources.
I will comment. I know the industry very well, and I think, believe it or not, there's some of the and I can say this honestly, some of the best talent in North America is located right here in Toronto. And I can name a few firms which are arguably some of the top players in the world. To go internationally, A, will never meet our deadlines. B, they don't know the community. And you're basically, for this to be an attractive process to sort of an international firm, you're essentially going to be handing the process off to them. We give them a terms of reference. We give them a budget. We give them parameters. They go away and come back. And then you'd be jurying. But it is not, it's not just logistically, it's not going to be as interactive as the community may look for. Whereas there is a lot of local design talent. And either way, whether it's the charrette or the competition process, there is that talent to act, you know, we can draw a number of firms locally and pre-qualify them. And that would not be a problem. Or if you chose to go the design charrette way, we could put together a panel of jurors that would be amongst the, you know, strongest designers that you are in the country today.
Okay, I'm going to take one more. Thank you, John, for that addition. One more comment on this, and then I'm going to push us forward because we have some technical content to get to answer other questions. So, Tony?
No, Mike, just a quick comment. I agree with what John is saying. I think there's lots of talent in the city, and we don't need to go around the world in 80 days or 80 hours to get this thing done. That's my comment, is that, you know, we've got lots of talent in the city, and that's a good thing. And I think they would be great. We'd have a great jury selection by going that route without having to expand our horizons. I think we have enough expertise to do that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. So that answers your question and addresses the second need that Councillor Fletcher asked for, which was a work back schedule. So we'll push forward whatever work back schedule based off your desire to move forward with either or a hybrid option of the others. Okay, so I'm going to move us into the next portion of our agenda. We do have one of our noise experts on the phone with us today to help us answer some of the technical questions related to the noise analysis. One thing that I did want to put on the table here that we have gone back to the drawing board with, essentially, we heard and listened to your major concerns about the material that was being presented for the noise walls, and we're putting material back on the table for opportunities for design. Now, there's still constraints around that, but we understand that you want to have input whether we use different, whatever type of material we use, whether it's acrylic, and we know that you want the best noise walls, and Metrolinx and Phil Verster's letter, everybody's committed to getting you the best noise walls. So that's what we're here to do today. So the material is back on the table. There are parameters around that. We still have the same fixed engineering constraints. So that's height, post and panel assembly, and post spacing. Okay, so those are fixed elements that, and those are going to go into the baseline. We will include the material conversation moving forward. Now that means that we still have constraints. There might be, you know, the acrylic material with a different type of material front facing. We'll have to talk through those through the design competition or the design process as we move forward. But I highlighted that in red so you can see that I moved that from fixed to opportunities. Shelley.
I would just like a drawing. I would like a perspective from the side of the corridor as it goes along as to how much is noise wall, how much is retaining wall, how much is noise wall, and how much of the trains are we seeing? We haven't seen anything like that, I don't believe, but and in different areas because there are different heights of the retaining walls. So as we're making these choices, I would like to understand what is backing on to the wall noise walls. We need to understand if it's residential or park, and what are the heights of the trains like. And what do I see from the west and what do I see from the east? So, of course, we have the west side, which is Ontario Line. And what do I see from the east side? And if we could have drawings that help us envision as we are making noise wall selections and looking at materials, that would be like 100% helpful. So if that's possible.
we can definitely, and I don't want to speak for Claudia and Rachel and Celia on the call, but I'm going to. I think we can work towards those graphics. But I do want to say, like, in the charrette process, again, I'm not trying to lead the witness here, but in the charrette process, like, that is exact type of iteration that we're talking about. You like this? Well, what if we did this? Then we iterate and we bring that back to you. So those, again, are processes through this back and forth dialogue that we're really trying to achieve and get to. So, but we can certainly, you know, after today's conversation, start that baseline perspective. So at least we have something to start working from. So you can see what, you know, even if we just move forward with the transparent noise walls today, you can still get that view from either perspective and see how it interacts with the train. I think that's something we can certainly commit to.
Yeah, so, and I think that, and I would just, sorry, I would just add that that kind of language needs to be in the RFP as well, if we do that, because they need to understand that it's, that this is on the table, that these are options on the table, that you don't have to have a certain length of panel, that there are, that you can play with them. And I would like to understand what it looks like in different areas. So we could say, you know, you can have a different take on a park as opposed to backing onto a residential neighborhood, as opposed to, you know, a dead end of a street. So, I mean, I think that kind of language needs to be in the RFP.
Okay, great. Okay, excellent. Okay, next slide. So just, I'm going to tee up our John, who's our noise expert, just to go quickly through some of the findings from the noise analysis. Just want to make some clarifications, just baseline understanding of what we're talking about today. There are really two types of noise barriers. There's reflective and absorptive, and we looked at those along the entire joint corridor. So reflective barriers are really what we've moved forward with so far to date. So typically they're transparent, or they have some sort of coloring feature, or they're opaque with some sort of design. They do minimize visual impact to the community and allow light to pass through. So those are some of the benefits. And then they are resistant to weathering, and then they have that single unit panel, so they're easier to fix if those, you know, it's easier to replace one panel than a consistent or contiguous wall. Disadvantages for this particular type of barrier, it needs protection from graffiti, but all walls do, so that's not something that's unique. On the next slide, you can see the reflective barriers and, absorptive, sorry. And those have maximum visual impact because, again, they're more of a concrete or steel or wood barrier. They are not see-through. They do cast shadows. It does have some increased noise reduction dependent on, you know, all of the factors that go into our noise study and the mitigation. There are several material options compared to the acrylic option that we've showed. So again, you can see some examples on the right hand side, and it fully does hide the visual impacts of the trains in the corridor. So that's a completely different visual impact from what the see-through transparent looks like. Disadvantages is you only have opaque. It increases the scale of the wall. So this is something interesting to think about, right? We have the retaining wall and then you have the noise wall on top of it. So, you know, with that difference of design, it does increase what feels like a different scale of wall to the person on the street. Blocks view of sky, casts some shadows, ages with weathering, and multiple units per panel, and needs protection from graffiti. Again, all walls do. So that's just the baseline, again, just going into an understanding of what options are for materials. Jennifer, you have a comment.
Yeah, just wondering about how the walls work in terms of buildings that are higher than the walls now or in future. I know there's some buildings slated to be built right next to it that are several stories above potentially. So just wondering how that works.
So can I just clarify your question so I understand who to call on from our technical team? Are you asking if we consider planned development when we're evaluating impacts and mitigation provided by the noise wall? Or are you asking if we consider high rise or multi-story developments in the mitigation for noise wall development?
Probably both, but anything above the noise wall, how is that impacted in terms of sound? Is there any protection from sound for above?
Yes, there is. And we'll get, John can talk to specifics on that if you don't mind just waiting for the next couple slides. Okay, and Rosemary.
And maybe this is going to be covered later. If so, I apologize. But so it there's increased noise reduction. But I guess what we really need to know is how much better is it? I mean, are these twice as good or half or, you know, or barely better? So, yeah, but I presume you're going to get to that. Sorry.
Thanks. Yep. Yeah. And there's different criteria, too, that, you know, allow for more or less protection. So with that, then I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to John Vero. Who's going to walk us through some of the details. Now, again, you know, we recognize we had a lot of content into this presentation, and John just can probably talk about this all day. So if we need to do a more in-depth, detailed noise presentation, we're prepared to do that at the next meeting. We wanted to condense what we needed here today to make sure you had what you needed to help us move forward with this engagement process, but still get you some technical information. So, John, take it away.
Thank you, Teresa. Okay, yeah, so I'm just going to summarize the noise modeling that went into this study. So for noise modeling for Metrolinx or transit-based projects, typically we go by the MOE/GO transit draft protocol and the MOE-GTC protocol, which is the ambient noise level plus 5 dBA. Now, when I'm looking at ambient noise levels, this is typically existing traffic noise as well as train traffic noise. Now, so for the noise modeling, for this joint corridor, we decided to adopt a more stringent criteria. So when looking between Eastern Avenue and Pape Avenue, noise mitigation must be equal to or less than the higher of 55 dBA during the daytime, 50 dBA during the night, or baseline levels. Now, as the baseline levels or these ambient noise levels are greater than the daytime and nighttime levels of 55 and 50 dBA, the baseline levels do become the criteria for this analysis. Now, the noise model does not allow for this plus 5 dBA variation. So for our analysis and optimization, it's based on achieving the average noise levels across a 16-hour day and 8-hour nighttime periods, as well as looking at the instantaneous pass-by noise levels of 80 dBA for OL vehicles only. Now, there is no pass-by criteria for GO vehicles. So for barriers along the alignment, the barriers range in between 5 to 7 meters, with the minimum height of our barriers being 5 meters. Now, these barriers will be installed in a phased approach during the construction process, and this will be completed during the early works, package one.
Okay. We have a first question, John, so we'll pause really quickly for Tony.
John, thank you. I just want to clarify, we've been told all along that the noise barriers are a standard height of 5 meters, and that the retaining walls will range from 0 meters to 7 meters in height. So I need that clarified, because what you're saying here now is that the noise wall heights may be up to 7 meters. The worst case scenario is a 7 meter retaining wall and a 5 meter noise wall currently, which is 12 meters, which is around 40 feet high, which is scheduled to go at the dead end of First Avenue, just south of where the future Girard station will be. So if those numbers are changing, we need some clarification on that, please.
Yep. So the maximum height that we do go up to is 7 meters. We do have some barriers that are also 6 meters tall.
And so Tony, that's a change. I do have a graphic that we showed at our last presentation that actually showed. It was the noise. We're going to show that graphic again, but it doesn't have the same where we were showing the distance, or I'm sorry, the height changes. And so based off your comment, we can go back to that and give a total for both, if that would be helpful.
I think we have to see how it covers the trains. I want to see, like I said, I want to see a slice. I want to see the east side. I want to see the west side. I want to see what we see of the trains and what's backing onto it. I think that's essential before we make these kinds of decisions or we look at materials.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll do that, Shelley. Thank you. And I can give you that graphic, Tony. I think it would be easy just making sure that I would take, I have to combine two graphics, but I think it would be easy to get you that.
Yeah, week. I mean, I have all the graphics. I have all the designs in the sense of the heights of the walls on a graphic design that was sent by Metrolinx, and that's fine. So I understand how the heights vary down the corridor. My point would be, if, as John says, the noise walls are now going to be, in some cases, higher than 5 meters. They're going to 7. Where are they? And secondly, does that mean that the retaining wall is not going to be as tall, which is, you know, the concrete retaining wall is not as sexy, or it's less sexy than the noise walls. Not that either of them are very sexy, but the point is less concrete is a good thing.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Shelley, just one more comment.
Sorry,
yes, go ahead, Councillor.
Go ahead, Paula.
Stuff would have to be well known in the specifications before there's any design competition, because people are going to be designing heights. They're going to be looking at that, the interaction between the noise wall and the retaining wall, looking at it's quite complicated. I agree with Shelley. I'd certainly like to see just a notion of what that might look like, but it's all got to come together somehow, and the specifications have to be there. You're going to let those specifications shortly.
Yes, so, absolutely. And we'll put that together so we have clear parameters. Shelley?
Yeah, I just want to make a point because we're on record here. I don't want to spend a long time of it, but as we are recording this and the community is going to hear it, I want to dispute this noise modeling study 100%. You've modeled based on LEQs, which is all you're required to do, and baseline levels. And it's just ridiculous considering this is the 21st century and we're putting in 6 tracks of trains through a residential neighborhood, that you're not doing better than baseline levels. People don't hear trains in equalized averages. They hear it from LMAX, they hear it from peaks. You didn't even study what 4 GO train locomotives sound like passing on the corridor. None of that was modeled. So for the record, we're looking at greater absorptive noise wall materials because we don't buy this noise study. And you got away with it, but I'm telling you, we don't believe it.
Okay, thank you, Shelley. Okay, next slide. John?
Yep. Okay, so for our noise modeling, we employ the U.S. Federal Transport Administration, also known as USFTA method, and this is done through CADNA, which is an MECP-approved noise modeling software package. It's commonly used across North America by noise and vibration or consultants. So the noise barriers are modeled in our model as close to the tracks as possible, and this is within the approved spacing. We did take into consideration elevation contours from latest grading profiles, and this is important in getting the relative heights of the top of rail compared to the base of the noise barriers as well as the receptors. Now, the existing ambient noise levels for our model only include existing train traffic. Now, this is a conservative approach. However, we did include road traffic noise to high rises in close proximity to the corridor. So our noise model was also reviewed by 3 expert firms, including Hatch, AECOM, and then Stantec as well.
Okay, and so I'm going to acknowledge and allow John to continue moving forward that the community feels that there's not any mitigation or analysis done for buildings above 8 stories. And then what did we look like? We do have that one slide coming up that will help to address that. Okay, John, keep going.
Can I just ask, John, did you do an analysis with trains passing?
Yep, so for trains pass-bys, we only look at the train pass-by of the OL vehicles. And this had the limit of 80 dBA.
Okay.
Again. Okay. Let the record show that that's an LEQ average, and if we could take note of the Yale study I have just posted that sustained 80 dB can cause hearing damage. And I'd also like to go on the record and say that this hearing test, sound test, is not appropriate for this day and age. Thanks.
Thank you, Alex. Okay, John?
Confirm that you didn't use what the thing Alex has said, is it LEQ? Is that what you said, Alex?
No, they are not using LMAX, Paula. They're not using peak noise. They're averaging out the noise with the peak with the quiet, which is all the protocol says they have to do.
To confirm that that's the method that was used here.
Yes,
John, is that something that you can confirm today?
Yeah, the 16-hour LEQ and 8-hour LEQ for day and nighttime periods. And then the LMAX value for OL passbys, yes.
Okay, John, keep going.
Okay, so this slide here is just a comparative analysis between the acrylic and absorptive panels. We did go back and look at the difference in performance between these two panels. So just looking at the legend there on the bottom left, the orange bar represents the existing ambient noise levels consistent of existing train traffic. And then the light blue, we have the modeled noise with reflective barriers. The purple represents the model noise with absorptive barriers. And then the gray represents the modeled OL pass-by noise levels. Now, from this comparison, what we found was that the difference in noise levels between the absorptive and acrylic is between 1 to 4 dB. Now, when comparing that on a scale of impact, when looking at a 1 to 3 dB difference, that's quite insignificant, and it's actually below the threshold of hearing. So it's not noticeable. When looking at a 3 to 5 dB difference, this is where it becomes noticeable. And then anything above that is where we see the significant range. So for modeling for this corridor, we did go with the transparent panels, reflective panels, and this was a conservative approach.
Next slide. Thank you.
Can we get the raw data? I just find it very difficult to follow the numbers, but it'd be great to understand the actual readout and not kind of guesstimate where we're at here. If you could share a CSV or an Excel file of the actual sound recordings, it would be great. Thank you.
We'll have to just take that back. I know we can prepare a much more detailed presentation with the data behind all of this as well, if that would be preferred by the CAC.
And when this came up, we got
Rosemary?
Saw that the East York riding was one.
Well, can I just ask John to clarify? It looks to me then as if the reflective barriers are almost in every case as good or better than the absorptive ones, which seems like a very strange term that they call it absorptive if it's less absorbing than the acrylic. But is it also true that the orange, which is the ambient noise, is higher than either of those walls? So the ambient noise that we're hearing now is going to be more than what we're getting when we have the walls.
Yep, that's correct, because once we include the walls, the levels are reduced, right? So the ambient levels will be higher, and then once you put the mitigation in place of either the reflective barrier or the absorptive barrier, the levels are reduced to below the orange. And that's what the criteria was.
But there are places, sorry to interrupt, but for example, looking right kind of in the middle on the top at Logan Avenue and Girard, it looks like the noise levels are actually going to go higher than what we have right now.
So those lines are actually equal.
Are they? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
There was no situation except for some identified high-rise buildings, which I believe we get into. Where we see the levels were not able to be mitigated with high enough barriers.
Okay, thank you.
John, there's one comment about modeling for GO Train. Shelley's commenting. Shelley, go ahead and unmute. You have your hand up too. So.
Oh, I just wanted to comment. This is only OL pass-by noise. You didn't. What is this combined with four tracks of GO diesel trains?
No, this is only the OL pass-by.
Yeah, so this is not accurate. We shouldn't be looking at this at all. We're experiencing six tracks, so we need to see noise modeling on six tracks, not on two.
Okay, thank you, Shelley. Okay, let's move forward, John, to the next slide.
Okay, so this is showing the different noise optimization for barriers on bridges. So when looking at noise mitigation on bridges, we optimize to reduce the number of barriers on bridges. And this is basically due to the fact that the length of overpasses tend to be very small. with small exposure angles with nearby sensitive receptors. This made bridges very ideal for optimizing the length of barrier. And now when removing the barriers in our model, we were able to show that the sensitive receptors were actually within the criteria of noise, except for the area of Queen Street Bridge, where we actually require a 1 meter absorptive barrier. Now when looking at barriers on bridges, we tried to minimize the heights to below 3 meters. And this is due to the significant lateral wind loading that can complicate the design and significantly increase the cost of barriers. This is why we maintain the height of 1 meter for that bridge. We also did take into consideration some low-rise barriers or parapets that were included in the redesign of the Logan and Dundas bridges. And these parapets can target wheel-to-rail noise, which is the dominant noise source for LRT that do not have exhaust.
Can we, if this isn't inclusive of all the train traffic, let's just skip all of this because really none of this matters. We need to look at everything that includes everything. So this is great work. I'd love to look at the data that includes all six tracks. So let's keep going.
Okay, thank you.
Can we clarify that it's only the pass-through noise that was only regarding the OL trains?
John, can you clarify?
Yep, so pass-by levels were only considered for the OL because there's only the criteria for OL trains for pass-by levels with 80 dBA.
But the other two modeled options for reflective and absorptive barriers, that was for all of the trains, all of the noise that we are expecting?
All the noise, yes.
Does that help to clarify?
The bars on the charts shown there were for daytime levels.
For all the trains.
Yeah.
For all of the trains.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of the gray bar.
The gray bar only considered the OL and then the orange.
Okay,
yes,
thank
and
you.
Then, yeah.
Okay. We have a suggestion to move forward. We only have half an hour left and we want to get to our bridges. I have some questions related to the high rises. I want to get to that. Shelley and Jennifer, quick comment before we move forward.
Okay. Shelley here. Just want to note that you have Logan and Carla on the same street. It's very weird.
Yeah, that's probably oversight. We were pulling some stuff together pretty quickly, so we'll fix that typo. Okay, Jennifer?
It's Jennifer. Yeah, I'm just confused. Are you saying there is less noise mitigation in the area of Queen Street because of some wind issues if you make a wall higher? Like, can you please explain that again?
Yeah, so we found that removing the barrier on the Queen Street Bridge actually put us above the existing levels to the sensitive receptors to the south. We did require a 1 meter absorptive barrier along the Queen Street Bridge to reduce the levels to below existing pre-project levels. Now, we wanted to minimize the height of the barrier on the Queen Street Bridge due to the fact that there will be significant wind loading, which will complicate the design. And in fact, you don't really want to go past 3 meters high in terms of barrier height on bridges. And the 1 meter was significant enough to reduce the levels by 2 dB to the receptors to the south, which was enough.
Okay, thank you. Okay, next slide. So you had some questions related to some of the high rises. So I did want to point out that in the noise analysis, the Fontbonne Ministries actually has a better noise environment after the noise walls are constructed than what they have today, based off the analysis. The noise receptors did show that at Ray McCleary and Francis Beavis Manor, those areas have impacted receptors, and we are investigating receptor-based mitigation for those two locations. Okay, moving forward. Okay, just a couple of quick examples for the difference between the transparent, translucent, and opaque walls. Again, I think what we're really working towards with your input is that transparent and opaque, we're trying to find your preference and the materiality that has moved forward between those. On the next slide, you can see where we've applied this. Shelley, I don't think it gets directly to what you're asking for with the cross-section and the views from each side. But we've shown here what a translucent area could look like, or a translucent wall can look like, and then on the next slide, what an opaque wall could look like. And then, of course, Shelley, we do need to see the trains. We'll show you exactly that different cross-section that we talked about earlier. Recognize on this, again, the shadowing is not 100% in perspective. We're just starting to play around with this option as we decided the material that is on the table. So, moving forward. So in Rosemary's comments is, what can it look like after 30 years? Again, these are all comments that we would anticipate moving forward with you through that design process. And again, what we talked about earlier today on our presentation, what is fixed related to the noise walls is that height, post and panel assembly, and post spacing. But moving forward through the design charrette, design competition, we'd like to discuss material, the transparency and opacity, the color of the screens, and the bird collision deterrent decals. We can look at the mix of those, whether we do, you know, some sort of combination between the materials and more. So any questions on noise before we move to the bridge discussion?
Sorry, Teresa, I'm going to have to go, but I just want to make sure that in the budgeting part, and thank you for all this tonight, that the maintenance of the walls is included somewhere, so that whatever that would be, I think Rosemary was right, what's it look like in 30 years? But generally, there's always a maintenance agreement of some kind, and who would that be with, and what would that be, and et cetera, so that they're as close to the original condition as time goes on. Just wanted to add that in. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor. Okay, well, I'm going to move us forward to the next section of our agenda so we can talk about the bridges. At our last meeting, you asked for some more detailed information related to the bridges. So we're going to walk through those considerations and constraints and come back to that same type of present slide that talks about what are the constraints, but what are the opportunities. So first of all, context is really important as we consider the design for the bridges. So integrating the structural elements into the existing environment and maintaining that neighborhood character. So we weren't putting a place, a big infrastructure bridge, a big bridge into a community, you know, like we said here, that blends into or enhances a Victorian, warm, quiet, family-oriented personality of a neighborhood. We needed to meet city standards, so basically making sure that the specification of the bridge was on accessibility standards, vertical clearance of 5 meters was required, minimum sidewalk widths, and other safety standards. We really aimed to reduce the impact of the bridge itself by reducing the project footprint and minimizing impacts to homes, businesses, and nearby community facilities, and that also included through construction. Making sure connectivity was a key element in design, so making sure that the public realm elements were being further developed with this group, and making sure that connections to both sides of the communities was safe, accessible, and efficient, and then continuity, so making sure that wayfinding and visual appeal was carried forward through the design of all of the bridges. On the next slide, we've got just an example of what the existing bridge cross-section looks like here at Queen Street. So you've got a substandard vertical clearance of 3.9 meters. The design currently does not meet crime prevention through environmental design, and the 3-span bridge piers need to be improved to accommodate the safety standards that we just discussed. So on the next slide, you can see kind of the standard design for what we have moving forward. Again, this is the baseline engineering for the bridges moving forward. This is again Queen Street as a baseline example. This has improved vertical clearance to meet that 5 meter. That also reduces the vehicle impacts with the dewirements, which I think the community is probably well aware of. It has a clear span, so you get rid of all of the spans that were limiting some of the space, especially for those pedestrian and walkability improvements. better sight lines, public realm, pedestrian experience, and safety. This also offers opportunity for TTC transfers at the new OL station, and while maintaining that clear sidewalk, so that sidewalk width is a great improvement, also meets design standards for SEPTED. It narrows the bridge footprint, so it has a reduced footprint and reduced congestion footprint as well, and then there's opportunities for lighting improvements. Again, these are some simple standards that for all of the bridges that we're adhering to moving forward. Celia is actually going to talk to the next slide about the actual design and what it will the bridges will look like. Celia?
Yeah, so this is a simple 3D, and it's I just want to explain some of the things that are possible to change on the design. So the bridge type is set, but this is just showing how all of the elements can come together. And those are all of the transitions are sort of design opportunities. We have the higher noise barriers, and then it transitions to a bridge. The lower portion is the engineered bridge. The larger portion above it is the handrail. So it's the 1 meter of sound barrier and the walking barrier, but there's a lot of opportunity there that can be rendered in a different way. We have an example on the right. Using the plates, things can be attached to the bridge. You know, we're always trying to keep things simple, elegant, the way they come together. But materiality is another thing that's on the table. So we're showing we currently have weathering steel, but a painted finish is a possibility. The treatment on the side walls and the lighting concept below the bridge, it's going to be more spacious than it is today, but there's a lot you can do to improve the particularly the pedestrian environment when you're passing underneath the bridge. And then, of course, it's the finishes on the walls as they turn the corner into the park. One thing we wanted to say about the weathering steel is just, you know, to reflect the neighborhood, the Victorian houses in the neighborhood, the use of sort of some warm colors. But all of this is for discussion, as well as the possibility of using some of the surfaces of the infrastructure for, you know, as a background for artwork as well.
Okay, next slide. Okay, so like we've been talking about with the other items related to our engagement together about what's where are opportunities for design. The fixed engineering constraints for the bridges include the height, so that vertical clearance is necessary, that 5 meter vertical clearance is necessary to meet safety standards and some of the recommendations and requirements from the city. The footprint of the bridge is set, so that, you know, we're trying to minimize the footprint of impact where those bridges will be constructed or reconstructed. That abutment and pier location, especially that clear span bridge, is fixed, and the structure type that we talked about is fixed. But the opportunities for design input from this community is the underpass lighting and the underpass activation. I think Paul showed some really cool ideas of how to activate that space under the bridge to bring some additional community benefits, and that's something that we're willing to explore. The public art is, obviously open for design, the abutment finishes and how that interacts with adjacent property, and then the bridge span public realm. So you can see the Aurora example where you've got some cladding on the bridge to make it a little bit more customized to the community feel and look and what the community wants to celebrate. That is also on the table for discussion. So questions? Any comments? Yes, Rosemary.
Well, I just wanted to go back to the last comment where we talked about turning the corner into the park. You turn the corner from Queen if you were going west to go up Degrassi, and that's an area that we're really concerned about because it's such a narrow space and it looks like it's going to be a concrete wall. So you're not turning that corner into a park. And if you go in the other direction, and you're on the north side, it's Jimmy Simpson Community Center that will be next. So a transition to the community center is something that I think there should be some potential to explore in a design way. Anyway, just first thoughts.
Yeah, those are both really good comments. And I think exactly, again, whatever process we move forward, there's opportunities to explore different treatments to those areas in that iterative process to see what that would look like. So I think that's really good comment. And as we're starting to explore other renderings for visualization, I documented those two areas specifically. Jennifer.
I put in the chat, but I just want to emphasize that safety should be considered beyond lighting. There's been incidents where things have fallen from the ceiling from this bridge. I know it's very old, but just consider the safety of the pedestrians below and how to, you know, emphasize that to the greatest possibility given the amount of train traffic coming over this bridge in the future. When you're looking up and just passing through.
Great. Yeah, thank you. And then I think some of the SEPTED standards do help with some of that, but yeah, very good comments. Okay, and let's see who's next. I've got, I navigated away really quickly. Tony, you're next.
I just wanted to clarify, you said that the bridge design was in place. Is that what was specifically said by the last speaker? I didn't get her name, but is that cast in stone? Is that what you're saying? The actual design?
So I was trying to illustrate just all of the things that can still change about that design. If we can just go back one slide and maybe I can clarify. Can we just go backwards one slide? Yeah, so what can't be changed about, or what's fixed in this design is the type of bridge. So it's the lower portion there. It's that lower beam. That is the bridge. That's the engineering of the bridge. And then what we're trying to suggest is, all of the elements that surround it that can be designed. So the webbing or the decorative webbing, the treatment of the handrail above the 1 meter sound barrier that's on the thing, and then the treatment and the transitions and how all of the elements come together. There are details of those that have flexibility.
Yeah. Okay. So if you go, Tony, another way to look at it, it's listed down on the left-hand side of the next slide under the fixed engineering constraints. So it is that, that abutment and pier locations, and then the structure type is that specific bridge that Celia was watching. Yep, and that was Celia, who's our lead architect.
And what you're showing here is the underpass is basically a squared off scenario. There's no sort of archways there that we currently have on these bridges. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes.
Let me just ask a question related to Tony, and this might be for Celia and you and Claudia, but are there facade treatments that we can do on the underpass entryways that could accommodate that similar design?
That wouldn't be structural. On the abutment walls of the underpasses, we're limited in what we can do because there are what's called a REMA, but there are inspection requirements that we can't get around for any structural elements of a rail bridge. So, and that goes for a rail corridor. So you can do a lot with the abutment walls, but you can't overclad them because then they can't be visually inspected for potential failures. So yeah, I mean, we're trying to push the limits of what can be done and still meet our inspection and maintenance requirements.
Okay, thank you. Tony, was that it? Or I just want to make sure.
Yeah, that's fine. I know that, Paul Bakovich from from the CAC has shown many, many designs over the last few weeks, which we'll have to discuss. I mean, I'm not an architect, but he is, so we'll need to discuss internally what the impact of all this is. But you clarified for me what can and cannot be changed.
Excellent. And Catherine.
Hi. As I'm looking through some of these designs, I just want to make sure that we're being very cognizant of the different mobilities of people using these spaces. Can two wheelchairs pass each other under the bridge, and a pedestrian if they're all approaching the bridge at the same time type of idea?
Yeah, if you move up, and Celia or Rachel, if you want to unmute and talk about it, but if you go to the cross section for the clear span bridge, Paulette, I believe it's two slides up.
Yeah, so our minimum standard to achieve that is 2.1 meters. So we're in a good situation with 5.5 meter wide sidewalks. Well, so there,
when we do these pictures, if we could put in the fact that you are actually thinking about people with different mobility issues, whether it be a scooter or a wheelchair, try to pass someone on the sidewalk in a scooter on Leslie not so long ago, that's where this prompted me to think about this. So when we're doing new, especially in spaces where they were, you know, built so many years ago, trying to fit these new components in here, I don't see that through these pictures, don't see that fact you've thought about others with different type of mobility devices.
Yeah, that's a great comment and a lens we certainly need to use when developing these graphics. So I appreciate that comment. Okay, and Jennifer?
Yeah, just wondering is there potential to widen the sidewalk out into the Metrolinx property at this point? Obviously the road is a fixed width, but is there any opportunity that way?
Underneath the bridge span or beyond the bridge span?
Towards the north and towards the south.
Celia or Rachel? Rachel, go ahead.
Hi, Teresa. So Jennifer, the existing right-of-way in this area is 20.1 meters, and we're expanding it to 23.8 meters into the Metrolinx right-of-way to expand those sidewalk widths. So the existing sidewalk today is just under 3 meters. We're expanding it to 5.5 meters.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Okay, let's move forward really quickly. We have 10 minutes left for the city presentation. If we get to it today, we can always come back to it at another agenda. I just wanted to point out that what we're working towards and what we hope to get on an engagement path forward is to develop the design guidelines for the joint corridor. So, of course, some of this input would go into the addendums that we talked about for the contracts on the early works contracts to make sure that your input gets into the construction of that phase of that package. But ultimately, we would like this addendum to guide the process moving forward. So that's the goal of the two approaches that we provided with the design charrette and the design competition. If you move forward to the next slide, you can see, we've talked a lot about these, the pros and cons. The design competition, you know, it brings in those outside perspectives. It expands the range of knowledge and expertise. It's informed with CAC input and vision, but does not directly include in that process. It does have an independent jury and has precedence in the community, limits iteration, and has a condensed schedule. Pros of the charrette are that it's a community-led process. The iteration with the community is key to the successful outcomes, and it includes broader and more frequent engagement. It leverages existing staff and expertise. It does have an aggressive schedule and a major time commitment from all, because there's a lot of engagement touch points. And then not other options, but really more other features of both approaches will be other workshops, information meetings, pop-up events, walking tours, and street interviews. On the next slide, again, you'll see our schedule. Oh, we did want to point out that we do have worldly global experience. You know, on the TA team of transit projects, infrastructure projects, community planning, urban realm design projects from all over the world. So we can bring that to the table to help with the process moving forward. And then on the next slide, again, it's just the two. Yep, go ahead. Okay, next slide. Again, these are the approach, the proposed schedules. Open for input, we will make adjustments based off the spring breaks and in March, the March breaks, and we will adjust that schedule once we get the direction moving forward. What's on the table for you guys to discuss this week is your choice, preference in moving forward with a design competition, a design charrette, or some sort of combination of both, where we might have a more global advisory committee or some sort of engagement from a design competition type light process. So thank you, Shelley, for taking the lead on organizing your group and getting us input back. For next week's presentation, it sounds like you'd like a little bit more detailed presentation on noise. I just want to confirm that so I can tee up the team and ready to do that, or is just access to the report and data enough?
I think we want to see data for 6 tracks and not 2. I also wanted to ask if the April 25th deadline is movable for a competition.
Okay, let me take that back and get you an answer on that. Okay. Okay, excellent. Well, so that concludes what we had for our presentation tonight. Thank you for getting back to us before the end of the week, what your direction is moving forward. To inform that, I will get an answer for you on the date. And then I will also take the conversation about noise and see what we can do through that process and what our response to that request might be. I don't think I captured any more detailed requests for additional presentations outside of what we've got with the city presentation. Did I miss anything? Tony, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, Teresa, you would like confirmation from the group tonight by Friday, March the 4th, as to which engagement approach we would like. You'd like to know by this Friday. Is that correct?
Yes. Yep. Good. And then so for next meeting, what we're going to work towards is a draft terms of reference, no matter what. So, you know, we're going to continue that process this week. So when we meet next week, we're actually reviewing that together. So that will be our primary agenda. We're going to make sure, working with our partners at the city, that they're included in that iterative process this week to develop that TOR and then get that to you before our meeting next week. So you have time to make some adjustments and comments on that as well. Okay. And Paul asked the question of what is a design competition light? So, Paul, before you joined us today, we talked, I forget who had the comment, but somebody said, could ask the question if we could do a mixture of the design charrette with some elements of a design competition added to it. And so we talked about, you know, maybe there are some hybrid approaches to that where John Potter brought up a really good example of leveraging a design committee. You know, where we invite, instead of maybe doing the design competition and soliciting firms to actually do the competition, maybe we invite them in some sort of advisory capacity for the charrette process. That was what we talked about and why I used those words design light. Or I'm sorry, competition light. Rosemary?
Just for moving forward with things that we are going to be discussing later, I have so many more questions about bridges. I feel that we need to talk about that again next week as well. And I wonder, are we going to see a similar sort of a first image that we saw for the Queen Street one for the other bridges? Because they are each very unique and need separate treatments, I believe. Thank you.
And definitely that is definitely a part of the iterative process in the competition or charrette. So there are, you know, components of that input that need to be included specifically for each area through that design engagement process. And if you could clarify just for me really quickly, are there any specific questions that you have related to the bridges outside of those specific, like the aesthetic iteration of that? Or is there anything else that I can start to prepare for a presentation? Do you have any specific questions?
I think the one I'm really concerned about is at Girard and Carlaw, where it is very wide. It covers the entire intersection
And both that one and the one on Queen Street have stations on top. So I think that that deserves its own separate, I don't know, conversation. Thank you.
And the Rosemary,
that's covered by package three.
Yeah, Rosemary, you raised a good point that Girard and Queen have stations on top. And one of the things that we'll want to sort of bring to the working group's attention is that we're sort of, and what Celia was sort of starting to introduce was the idea that we want both sides of right now the Queen Bridge to speak to one another, not have one with a station and then the east side have no relation to what's going on. We want a kind of a unified experience for people at street level moving from east to west and west to east.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. And yes, we'll discuss how we can share information related to the footprint and simple renderings of those locations for next week. I see several comments. Let me just get caught up really quick with Shelley's comments. Okay, excellent. You need to see the entry and exit points of the station. So thank you. Good comment. Tony, any other comments from you?
Just briefly on the Girard Carlaw Bridge, some people will call it two bridges because there's one bridge going over Carlaw, one go over Girard, and it's very close and dear to my heart what's going to happen there. So I think we definitely need to see. Right now we've got you're actually going to be building an adjacent bridge to handle the two Ontario Line tracks to the west of the existing bridge. The bridge that's there now just will handle the four GO train tracks. Right now it's got three going across, but there will be a fourth. And both there and at Logan and Dundas, there will have to be an additional bridge built. So that's going to have an impact on what it looks like and what the details are, the design details are, which we've yet to see. It is not the same as the bridge at Queen. It's quite different and more complicated, I think.
Okay, good comment, Tony. And we'll start to put that together.
Thank you.
Can we ask, sorry, this is Julia from the Transit Expansion Office. Can Metrolinx just clarify the existing bridges, which of the existing bridges are to be replaced and where we are expecting new Ontario Line bridges? /stations.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a map that shows that clearly?
I don't think we have one in this presentation. I don't know. Let me take a look at the noise one and see what we have. I don't know, Rachel, do you have that list easily available?
Yeah, I can quickly run through that for you, Teresa. So we have a new GO bridge that will be replaced at Eastern Avenue, Queen Street, Dundas Street, and Logan Avenue. We're doing slight modifications to the existing Carlaw Avenue Bridge and Girard Street Bridge that support the GO tracks today. We will be building a new Ontario Line Bridge at Eastern Avenue, at Queen Street supporting the new station, at Dundas Street, at Logan Avenue, and a new bridge that will span both Girard and Carlaw Avenue at the intersection, supporting the new Ontario Line station at Girard and Carlaw.
Thank you. Teresa, slide 15 does cover it if you want to just show a quick visual, but I think Rachel explained it quite well.
Yeah, thank you. That's what I was on, but I don't have my glasses on, so I couldn't read the key, to be honest. So didn't want to call it out if it was not accurate. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Okay, well, we're right past 8:00. Sounds like we've got some additional bridge questions that we need to answer for next week. We've got a question related to the full build out, a noise study related to all six tracks. We will get a date if there is option to move the date for the design competition to you, Shelley, early this week. And then we will add the parks presentation to our next agenda as well. Any final comments or parting shots today? Tony, your hand's still up. I just want to make sure you don't have anything. Okay, great. Okay, well, thank you. This was a great meeting, everybody, and we appreciate your engagement, and we hope you have a wonderful evening. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.